Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show improve. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
African Americans were roundly disparaged by eugenic theory, as scientists continue to seek and find wide physiological evidence of black inferiority. In a refinement of earlier scientific racism, eugenics was appropriated to label black women as sexually indiscriminate and as bad mothers who were constrained by biology to give birth to defective children. The demonization of black parents, particularly mothers, as medically and behaviorally unfit, has a long history. But 20th century eugenicists provided the necessary biological underpinnings to scientifically validate these beliefs. The sexual irrepressibility and the bad mothering were biologically located in the hereditary apparatus, they contended. Thus, eugenics undergirded medico-social movements that placed the sexual behavior and reproduction of blacks under strict scrutiny and disproportionately forced them into sterility, both temporary and permanent. Scientists also vigorously researched black fertility, compiling data on black birth rates and using women of color predominantly to test many reproductive technologies and strategies, from involuntary sterilization to Norplant to the shot. In 1915, Dr. Harry J. Heiselden heralded the first wave of U.S. eugenics when he gained fame and wealth by exploiting the evil legacy of the black mother. Heiselden was as famous in his time as Dr. Jack Kevorkian was in our own, and for an eerily similar reason. Both hastened the death of those they perceived as unfit for life, and both chose their victims from the poles of life. Kevorkian preyed upon the old or ill. Heiselden on sick, defective infants. On November 12, 1915, he announced to newspapers that he had allowed the ailing but viable newborn of his patient, Anna Bollinger, to die in Chicago's German-American hospital because he would have gone through life as a defective. Between 1915 and 1918, Heiselden killed five other babies, drawing fawning attention from the press each time. Practicing negative eugenics very publicly, Heiselden encouraged parents and other pediatricians to follow his example by killing or allowing the deaths of the genetically inferior. Parents began openly to recruit doctors to kill their children who were born with birth defects, and doctors came forward with their own proud confessions of infanticide. Like Kevorkian, Heiselden arranged photo ops with his dying patients and their mothers. When he decided to make a film to popularize his eugenic ideals, starring himself, it became a hit, making him a wealthy movie star. That film was The Black Stork. It begins with the story of a white, wealthy, well-born slave owner who, in a moment of inebriation, is seduced by his vile, filthy black servant. The resulting child supplies a genetic taint to his family that haunts his progeny, making them unfit to marry. One scene showcases a panoply of defective children, and the very first image is that of a black child. In titling the film, Heiselden was mindful of both the negative and the racial connotations of the word black. Martin Pernick, Ph.D., the premier expert on Heiselden and his work, points out that Heiselden repeatedly equated black with ugliness and undesirability. The fact that her white master, but not she, must be addled by drink before they have sexual congress speaks to the black woman's innate shamelessness. At the film's end, the tainted descendant of the Union is subjected to euthanasia, with the approval of a berobed Jesus who stands over the cradle. This ham-handed bit of eugenic propaganda buoyed popular sentiment toward eugenics. Soon, life began to imitate Heiselden's art.
Context of White Supremacy, Gus T. Renegade, in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Tuesday, December 5th, 2017. So I have been told. Update, thankfully, the iTunes feed, the technical issues that we've had for about 2 weeks now have been corrected. So our iTunes feed updated. It is current. All of the broadcasts that have taken place over the last 2 weeks or so, I think that's at least 8 different episodes, but they should all be available for streaming, downloading via iTunes. Again, this was a problem that was beyond Gus T, and I think was a site-wide problem, allegedly was an issue for lots of people. So that has been corrected. If that's how you normally access the program, just refresh your iTunes feed for the cows and all of the broadcasts should be available. That said, the audio segment you heard at the beginning of the program, I will confess that I generally will take any opportunity to reference or read a portion, share a bit from Harriet A. Washington's phenomenal book, Medical Apartheid, The Dark History of Medical Experimentation on Black Americans from Colonial Times to the present, one of my top 5 books and a text that we got to read in our book club. I think that has a lot to do with some of the issues that we are going to discuss on the program this evening. And this is a subject that I think we've covered a number of times. I'm reminded Dorothy Roberts, Killing the Black Body, another phenomenal book, top 10. Ms. Shafia Monroe, she's the founder of the International Center for Traditional Childbearing. She was with us on the program back in 2012. Even Mark Crutcher did the documentary Ma'afa 21. Was with us back in 2009. Very important themes, issues that we are discussing this evening. If folks remember, just a few weeks ago, Ann Simmons, The Importance of Black Journalists, try to emphasize that on the broadcast often. She did two just really superb essays in the LA Times, both addressing maternal mortality rates, the crisis levels of maternal mortality rates facing black females in the United States. And she had a lot of great resources. She linked to a lot of great people that are doing work to address this issue. One of the folks that she referenced is with us this evening. Real pleasure to have her on the program. She is the founder or co-founder and executive director of the AFIA Center down in the Dallas-Fort Worth, Texas area. So glad to have her on the broadcast. Joining us live, Ms. Marcia Jones. Ms. Jones, you're with us?
Yes, I am still here and I'm excited to be here.
Thank you so much for sharing a bit of your Tuesday evening. If you could share with our listeners a bit of what you do and what the AFIA Center is all about.
I'm sorry. So the AFIA Center, we were founded 3 years ago. We were about to be 10 years old. And what brought us into this work was that we were concerned with this whole narrative of black women and HIV. And so we were very clear that black women were not getting HIV because our behavior was that of any different from any other woman. We were not more promiscuous. We were not having sex with more people. As a matter of fact, black women tend to be committed in their relationships and committed to their men or whomever they're in a relationship with. And so we just wanted to change that narrative. We just did not want to see this story about black women being, you know, I mean, like, we just didn't want to continue with this all this historical content of black women being over-sexualized, the over-sexualization of black women. And so we wanted to talk about the real problem that was going on with HIV and black women. And we wanted to talk about environmental justice. We wanted to talk about economic justice. We wanted to talk about racism. We wanted to put all of those things in place before we started to really address what HIV would look like and why HIV looked the way it looked among black women. And so that's kind of how we got started. And from there, we started to take on other issues that was impacting the lives of black women. And we were very unapologetic in our work. We do not do our work under the umbrella of women of color. We do our work under the umbrella of black women of color, because we don't want to leave any black women out of the conversation. And so we do this unapologetically, and doing it that way, we didn't suffer, but of course we didn't get funding. We didn't get any of these kind of things, but it allowed us the opportunity to create a program that would be more reflective of the women that we were serving. From there, it just made sense that we would also have conversations or start to do work in, as it related to reproductive justice and reproductive rights and reproductive health of women, of black women of color, which also take us into an area that can be controversial, which is the show I was just trying to referee a minute ago, because we do support choice. We support black women being able to make a choice as to whether or not they're going to have a child or not have a child. That's reproductive justice, the right to parent, to not parent, and to parent the children we have in a safe environment that's free from state sanctioned violence and any other kind of violence, environmental violence and all of that. And so that's what we do. So we fight really hard. We go to our legislation and we do all we can do being a 501c3 to raise up issues that impact black women of color the most. We do that on a national level as well as a state level and a local level, talking about how race and gender and class impact black women and how we live our lives today.
Marcia,
that's kind of what brought us to the black women. That's what brought us into this whole maternal mortality thing.
I see. Right on. Again, Marcia Jones, co-founder, executive director of the AFIA Center. If you want to get more information, you can go to their website, theafiacenter.org. Should be linked in the description. Address again, theafiacenter.org. For folks, and you can see photos on the website. For folks who have not seen you, you are a black female. Is that correct?
Yes, I am. I'm a black woman.
Gotcha. Yes, ma'am. You said that you deliberately, in the focus of what the AFIA Center is about, focusing on black females, reproductive justice, you wanted to talk about racism. Do you have a definition of racism that you all use when you talk about these issues?
We talk about racism in a sense of the fact that racism, of course, is not an ethnicity. It's not who we are as people. It's a social construct that was made up by people who at some point felt that they were in control, who wanted to maintain control and use race in order to maintain control, and began to teach and began to orchestrate thought processes and ideas that made one particular people less inferior to another particular people based on the color of our skin. That's kind of how we teach it. And we teach that if you are white, you do benefit from race. And no matter how that look, you benefit from it. And we also teach that if you are black, you cannot be racist.
Are folks resistant in the organ? Like you said, you just had the referee. Like,
yeah,
is that one? I'm sorry?
Oh, that was one of the church kind of conversations, you know, whereby you have all these church folks who are like 115 years old now making judgment calls on other church folk, on decisions that they're making in their young lives, like they've never made a decision that was not in conflict of, I guess, morality or whatever. Mm. And so I just needed to, because I have some folk who are doing the show for me today. And all the time, people are not, they don't have the tools, you know, to defend themselves against this stuff, especially when we start talking about church And so, you know, we have, I just wanted to go in and say, hey, you know, let's like the straightness out here. What we're not going to do is have a conversation like that unless you can bring some value to the conversation. But we're not going to judge and tear people down. We're not going to do that. Not other black, not young black folk anyway.
Wonderful.
We want to do that if you feel so.
Wonderful. But people are accepting of the definition of racism the way that you outlined it.
I have conversations with people almost not every day, but I know weekly that say, yeah, black people can be racist. No, we can't. Like, stop that, please. You know, I work with white women. I have, you know, white women that I do this work with, you know, and I'm consistently saying to them, you know, I don't care how you come into this work, you come into this work from a place of privilege. You might not like it, but you do. There are things that you can do to identify this. What I'm not going to do is try and go fix your white people. You're going to fix them. I'm going to do what I can do with black people. But what we're not going to do is sit here and play like you don't sit in this space with privilege. And it is your whiteness that brings you privilege. It's not an easy conversation to have. I know it's not an easy conversation to have. It's not an easy conversation to have with black people. But I'm going to have it. I'm going to continue to have it. I owe that to the universe.
Wow. That's a wow. Do you think it would be more accurate to say that these white women that come to work with you all and you present, you know, the way that you outline racism, white supremacy, and they're resistant to that? Do you think it would be more accurate to say that they are present with power? You said privilege. Do you think it would be more accurate to say that they are there with their white power?
Yes, it is definitely more accurate to say that. I just didn't say it, but that's probably what I was alluding to, but yes.
Okay, right on. I found that one of the problems when we start talking about these issues of racism, people don't use the most accurate terms to describe things. I've found that white people often do that intentionally. And I think power is a much more accurate term than privilege. Privilege kind of makes it a very passive thing. Like, you can just hang out and have things given to you and you don't have to do anything. And I've concluded that white supremacy, race, the black maternal mortality rates, that is a very active thing you have to be engaged in to have black people have generational health problems and all the other ways that racism, white supremacy plays out. You can't just not do anything. You have to be actively engaged to maintain white power practicing racism.
I love that way. And thank you for saying that, because I'm always open. You know, I've changed even the way we say black women. We used to say black women and other women of color. Mm-hmm. And we was doing some work on black feminism and womanism and stuff. And I was reading the definitions of or some of the components of black feminism. And it talked about power among all black women of color. And that just sat with me. And that was a very powerful statement to make, because all black women are not necessarily the way we see it, but they are black women. And so I wanted to quit just saying black women and other women of color or whatever. I just want to be very specific, and I wanted to include all black women of many colors. We come in so many different ways. And so I'm always open to something new. So next time you hear me talk, I'll be talking about white folk and their power, not their privilege.
Right on. In Ann Simmons' LA Times article, she really emphasized, and she titled it The Quiet Crisis, talking about the maternal mortality rates. I guess before we even, I want to read this quote, but just for listeners who might not be aware, can you explain what we mean when we say maternal mortality rates with black females?
So what it means is that women, black women or women who die within a year of giving birth, for something like not like a car accident or something directly specific to their health within a year of giving birth, that's maternal mortality. So it's within that year. That's kind of the short and dirty of it.
Okay. Get into more specifics when you...
So like if they left and got in a car accident, so it's like, so they're dying from like high blood pressure, eclampsia, hemorrhaging, what are some of the others? Hemorrhaging, eclampsia, high blood pressure, diabetes, those diseases. There are further on down the line, substance abuse, or it may have been an overdose or something like that. But for the better part, it's those diseases at the top that I mentioned.
I see. Okay. Ann Simmons, a black journalist, she wrote this in the LA Times. She said, when it comes to the natural process of childbearing, women in the U.S. die in much higher numbers than those in most developed nations, where maternal deaths are generally declining. This seems to be an overall problem in the United States. Why do you think that is in general?
So that seemed to be a question that we really seem like we're searching and searching for an answer. I would say in the United States, it could possibly be because we don't value the lives of women. We don't value women's lives. When you talk about black women, they're valued even less. There's no value attached to our lives at all, except for what can be gained from us. And so because we are living in, like, I don't know, this political climate that we're living in now, not just because this person was elected, this person is holding the White House hostage, not necessarily because of that, because this was going on prior to him being there. I just believe, I don't, you know, like I said, I can't give you like a hard answer to it because I'm not a doctor. I don't know all of these things, but it just seemed that there's this thing around abortions and women's reproductive health choices and putting in place policies that decrease women's access to health care, not having the real conversations about why white men of power want to end abortions, because it's not because they don't want black women to have them. If they had a choice, they'd kill all the black babies. They don't want white women to have abortions, so, you know, because they want to make sure that white women can continue to populate the world and that white men or whomever can still kind of call themselves a majority. So we don't want to have those kind of conversations. And so we are using this cover to stop abortions and ending and not and lowering or decreasing access to people having affordable kind of sort of health care, so that we can kind of get in care for these conditions that we've had, that we continue to have. And then we have babies and then we die because we don't value the woman's life. We only value the baby's life, and the baby's life is valuable too. I don't know. It seems like I'm rambling, but I do this because I don't know why come women in general are dying from childbirth, but I do feel like I believe I know why black women are dying, and black women are dying because we're black women. And it's the way that we enter the healthcare systems, the way we're treated when we enter the healthcare systems, how conditions in black people continually to be overlooked. So there's no value to us. So when we come in the hospital and we say to the doctor, yeah, I had this baby, but I'm sick, and they say, yeah, you're good, go on. And then we go home and die. But had we been a white woman who had those same conditions, like the woman, daughter in Ann's article, had a white woman presented to the hospital that often with that condition, there's no way she would be dead now. So I don't really know why we're dying, except for the fact that there's no value on our lives. And so if nobody cares that we're dying, then nobody going to notice that we're gone. And it's very frustrating. It's very frustrating for me. I can't believe that this is going on and nobody was talking about it prior to 2016 or whenever the article came out in Texas. And well, I read an article in 2015 that talked about black women 50 years after the civil rights movement and where are black women now. And it talked about that. And it said that in that article that was written by the Black Women's Roundtable, that black women in America had a higher chance of dying from childbirth than women in Lebanon. I said then, my God, what is going on in my state in Texas? I had no funding. I had no money. I didn't know how I was going to bring this up, but I knew I was going to do some work around it. So it is very frustrating. And we know that black women are dying. We know that this is centered in race.
context.
And we're not talking about that way. We keep trying to look for medical reasons. Yeah, we know medical reasons. We know it's cardiovascular. We know it's hemorrhaging, or we know it's eclampsia or whatever. But no, that is not the foundation or the root cause of this. And if it be that, then why are Black women suffering from these conditions at such a high rate? And I sound like I'm raising my voice at you, but I get so, it's just, I don't know. When I talk about this, I cannot believe that this is happening. I can believe it, but I'm just saying, and people are not alarmed. We're still talking to people who didn't know that this is happening right here in this state. I know it's happening in more than this state, but that didn't know.
Context of white supremacy. I appreciate your candor. That's why I'm really glad to have you on the program, hopefully to inform more folks and to let people know about the great work that you're doing. You emphasized your state, Texas. You all did a research report that came out in the spring of this year, The State of Black Women in Texas. We Can't Watch Black Women Die. And I wanted to read a portion just to give some of the information about Texas specifically. Historically, Black women have been 4 times more likely than white women to die from complications. In Texas, the state with the worst maternal mortality rate in the developed world, the situation is even more dire. Between 2011 and 2012, maternal mortality rates in Texas doubled, hitting a high of 33 per 100,000 live births in 2012, according to a study published last year by the Journal of Obstetrics and Gynecology. I'm skipping down a little bit. Maternal deaths in Texas have been mentioned sparingly during the legislative session, overshadowed by issues such as child welfare, additional unnecessary abortion restrictions, the so-called bathroom bill, and sanctuary cities. What do you think it is specific about Texas that has just this alarmingly high rate above and beyond what you see from Black females in other areas of the U.S.?
Well, we have a legislation here, a group of legislators here in Texas that historically not prioritize Black people's lives. And this is no different. We have legislators who don't prioritize women's lives. Period, in this state. We have legislators who do everything in their power to put together legislation that makes absolutely no sense, that is very harmful to women. And so when you're doing this, of course, Black folk are going to be impacted by it the most. Even if you don't set out and say, I'm doing this to hurt Black folk, if you do it, it's going to hurt Black folk the most, because on some level, we're already starting from the bottom, almost, it seemed like. And so if we're kind of starting from the bottom in a state like Texas, then, I mean, you know, we're already there. Because we're talking about Black folks, Texas is a very red state. And we're talking about this particular group of people. Nobody, like, these people who go to the polls and vote, and they know that this type of thing is happening. They are not concerned about that. The constituencies here, they don't care that these women are dying. All they're concerned with is making sure that this white power, that it stays in control in a state like Texas. And so if nobody is going to talk about it, then they have no reason to move on it. Do I think that they wake up in the morning and go to the legislature and say, you know what? We're going to pass some laws here that's going to make sure that Black women die after they have children. No, I don't think that they do that. But I do think that when those things come across their desk, they don't care because of whom this being impacted. We had a legislator who said and was not ashamed to say it. If Black women didn't drink and do all the things that we do, we wouldn't die when we had babies. He said that, a legislator. And he didn't even try to fix it. And guess what? He didn't have to, because the people who vote for him, they're going to continue to vote for him because they feel the way he feels. And so this is not a priority. It's not just maternal mortality. It's the same thing when we're talking about HIV. I've been doing this work for 10 years, and I've never gotten any funding from the state of Texas to do work with women living with HIV. And we have proven the way we do it will work when we deal with the whole woman and not just that thing in her life. But we've never gotten funded to do it because we don't do it the way that we want to do it, the way they say do it in the state of Texas. It's going to be demoralizing and dehumanizing to Black women. So this is nothing different. It's just that this report came out and we now see it. But Black women have been dying, have been leaving the hospital sick, have been suffering through this. This is nothing new. We just see the report now. And I don't think there is no one particular reason why it's happening. It's just that we have a red state that's run by a group of men. We have very few, you know, I'm not even going to say we have women, because there are women who, they sit there too and vote against this stuff. But we have a red state run by these men, these white men, who have this power that they're going to walk in, that they're going to exercise, and they're going to use it to stay in control and stay in power. And that's what they're going to do. And they've done this. We've not had a female or a Democratic, not that that would make that much of a difference, because I said to somebody, if we had all Democrats up there, it would still be the same. They were the same old white man running the system. But we had Ann Richards many years ago, who she was, you know, she was different from what we were accustomed to having in Texas. But since then, it's been from one idiot to the next running this state. And they win every time with no opposition. I mean, it's like a clear slate. They run, they win, they run, they win. They put together this. They put out this dangerous legislation, and nobody votes to change it in any way. I mean, Black women still don't make as much money as white women in the state of Texas doing the same job.
No surprise there either. System of white supremacy.
I mean,
with Texas specifically, I thought this was really important as well. This is from the report that you all issued this year. And you were talking about policy issues with regards to laws, legislation that is driving this problem. You talked about how in 2011, the state, they went on this drive to put Planned Parenthood out of business. And so they stopped funding a lot of these sites. And you write, the Obama administration made clear that Texas's action violated federal law by discriminating against qualified providers. Governor Rick Perry remained insistent, which led to the state of Texas losing all federal support for the Women's Health Program, $9 for every dollar spent. As of January 2013, the program is an entirely state-run effort with a more limited provider network and significantly fewer enrollees, and delivered thousands fewer contraceptive and related services during the first months of operation. I thought this was really important, just because another example of turning down a lot of money to push forward this initiative, which had really disastrous consequences for the health of Black females in Texas. Is that accurate?
Yes, it's accurate. And even now, even today as we speak, because part of the problem with them, with this whole thing around defunding Planned Parenthood, and they did, and some Planned Parenthood did close, but Planned Parenthood is going to be all right. Trust and believe that. But you have all these other small clinics that were filling the gap for a Planned Parenthood. You know, the little clinics on the corners, or the clinics that was run by physician's assistants or whatever. You know, like the smaller clinics within our communities. Those clinics also suffered when that funding was lost. And those are clinics that was familiar to many of these women, where they got their services from. And so when they stopped those programs, when they shut down those funding, and over time caused many, many clinics to close that we don't hear about, then you interfere, you interrupt continuity of care, and you take away trusted services where women have gone to receive these services, and they are affordable. Because many times these women still didn't have access to insurance or health care or whatever. I mean, insurance. But these services were at a rate that, for the better part, people could pay out of pocket, you know, to just, you know, maybe $30 or $40 to visit, to have a doctor's visit. Now you've removed this. And so what are people going to do now? They cannot access even the services that are there, the services that the state of Texas put in place. You read the data. It wasn't effective at all. And even now, as we talk about maternal mortality, so women are pregnant and they didn't have any insurance, and so they get this emergency Medicaid for being pregnant. But then that's over in like 60 days after they have the baby. These women are dying anywhere from 45 days to a year from having the baby. So what we're saying is that these women have this care. They don't get to get maybe but one and a half postpartum visits to a physician using that Medicaid that they had that was emergency. But they're supposed to be automatically enrolled in a Texas healthcare program, right? Well, not even 20%. Now, over 200,000 women know about the program or whatever, or they are electronically enrolled or something, but less than 20% of the women access it because it's not working. It's not efficient. There's no program in place that makes sure that these women know that they're enrolled, that they even know where to go, that they know the next steps to take in order to see that doctor for those next few postpartum exams that could possibly prevent them from dying. The programs are not working. Here it is 2017, and they're still not working. Because Texas want to be a standalone.
Context of white supremacy. Again, Ms. Marsha Jones, if you have questions, certainly we have black mothers or expecting mothers. Feel free, chime in. The number 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you have questions. And you can download the report that I've been reading from, The State of Black Women in Texas. We Can't Watch Black Women Die. You can download that from the AFIACenter.org. Great information. Pass that around. You said that the program that you all have, that you've been using to holistically treat black females who have HIV, can you describe some of what you all have been doing that's proved to be efficient, effective?
So one of the things that we do, we don't start at diagnosis. We don't start at behavior. We start at bringing women in and starting to talk about their beginning of their life as far back as they can remember, and identifying places in their life where they experienced trauma and how that trauma created risk. I mean, how that trauma created vulnerabilities that then created risk. And so that by that I mean just the trauma of being a black woman, the trauma of growing up black, being made to feel less than, being made to feel ugly, being made to feel all of those things, trying to live up to an expectation of beauty, of success that was not made for you, but still trying to live up to that, and how those things can cause you to get in relationships or be in situations that so traumatize you that you begin to make decisions that will put you at risk for becoming infected with HIV. We talk about how where you live, living in areas that's very poor or don't have access to things, which then means that you, again, are having to make decisions that dictate how you will and will not have sex and with whom you will and will not have sex with. We talk about how having not access to housing, having not access to feeling safe, needing to feel belong, or needing to feel a part of, or needing to feel loved, and how all of these things can dictate how you have sex and whom you have sex with. And coming from broken homes or whatever, where there's no father, and even where there's no mother, and how these things also dictate how you see yourself, and how it will lead to sexual decisions that you make, and then affirming women in these spaces where they are. So what if you have four children and they all have four different fathers? It don't make you any worse of a woman. So we find ways to affirm women. We find ways to help women to love themselves. We embrace who we are as Black women. We embrace our size. We embrace our color. We embrace our hair. We just affirm and love on each other and talk in very safe spaces and in very safe ways. And we do this in a way that we're not going to be judged, that we don't have to run from it. And so in doing this, it helps women to identify or to understand their diagnosis. Now, in the process of doing all of that, so that women have health, so that they have a healthy outcome, we also talk about HIV and how important it is to take their medication and what it means to take their medication and how to understand the science of HIV. So what's going on in your body, why you have this HIV, and how this medicine impacts your body, and also how your body impacts the medicine. We talk about substance abuse and how that will impact how you live with your HIV. We talk about stress. We do talk about relationships, but not in a way that it demonizes Black men. So we don't kind of have conversations around Black men on the down low, having sex with men and coming back and having sex with women. We don't talk about the fact that Black men all going to prison and having sex with men while they in prison and coming home. No, we talk about it in a way that we know that that could very well happen. But what we want to do is we want to embrace the entire community. And so if you are a Black woman and you love a Black man that's in prison, we're not going to judge you on that or demonize that situation. And neither are we going to demonize that Black man. We're going to love you where you are in loving that man who's in prison or loving that man who's struggling right now. But also, how do we work together so that both me and this man or me and this woman, whomever it is you choose to be with, that we can be better. So we do this really holistically. We look at the whole entire lived experiences of women, and we point out systems that's been put in place that was designed for us to fail. And how do we need to start to create our own system? We also have, and within this program, we talk with women about ways in which they made money prior to their diagnosis. So if they made jewelry, if they have skills where they can make jewelry, where they can do quilting or any of these kind of things, how they can then start to create ways of creating money or funds or whatever, discretionary funds that they can save and use for emergencies a long time so that they can start to work themselves or work their way out of poverty, however they define it. Because we know that HIV is not just driven by how our behavior, but it's driven by poverty, it's driven by race, it's driven by class and all of these things. So that's kind of what we do. We have a program called Living Out Loud with Purpose. And so Living Out Loud, it's a 5-piece component, and it takes in all of those things into consideration of our lives as Black women. And it's an intricate life that we lead, and it's unique from any other woman. We are unique from any other woman in this world, Black women of color are. And so how do we embrace that and be okay? So that's how we work with women who are living with HIV, and those are the same kind of conversations we have with women who are not. So it's kind of sort of just Black women sitting in the space having kitchen table conversations.
You mentioned that.
That tells you it works. I was going to say it worked because the women who have come through our program, we have women. I have one young woman who, when she came to us, she was taking all kinds of psychotropic drugs. She takes nothing now. She don't take any psychotropic drugs anymore. And she's perfectly okay. We have women who never relapsed again and who's not on drugs. Women who have gone back to college, who've gotten married, who you wouldn't even know that they were still HIV positive. I mean, our program works. It works.
Spectacular. The AFEACenter.org. You talked about how substance abuse can interact with regards to the treatment programs and what have you. And that's also mentioned prominently with the issue regarding maternal mortality rates, drug overdoses being a substantial contributor. Can you talk about what drugs specifically, from your understanding, are contributing to this problem?
Well, the drug overdose, for the better part, is not a really big one with Black women. Mm. The drug overdoses, for the better part, is opiates or whatever, is a white woman thing.
I see. In fact, I was going to ask.
I mean, yeah. But for the better part, for Black women, it would probably be over-medicating. You're in a lot of pain. You're going to the doctor. They're not treating you, and so you're self-medicating and over-medicating. And then some of it would be depression. So it may even be suicide or whatever, taking those pills, because there is such a thing called postpartum depression. Mm. Black women are already very stressed. We're already coming into a very stressful environment. We're going back home sometimes without a support system in place. And so the same thing that was going on prior to us having our children, that's going on when we come back. So you're going back to not having enough resources to take care of your family, having to be the protector of all things in that house, of the caregiver for everything there, on top of the fact that you are having some things going on with your body that you can't explain and nobody's telling you that. And so we are doing what anybody else would do. People self-medicate all the time. And in self-medicating, you may over-medicate. And if there, maybe with some mental health issues that have not been diagnosed. And so here's a woman who may very well have already had mental health issues going on, not diagnosed. We send her home, and then we expect her to be okay. And so there may be self-medicating there because sometimes, a lot of times, mental health issues are often overlooked. In Black communities and with Black people, we just attribute it to us having just bad behavior. The representative theory, Sean Theory, who I believe she was also in the article, she at the regular session, we talk a lot about the bill that she introduced around being specific and looking at why Black women are dying. She also had a bill being very specific about Medicaid or Medicare screening to pay for women, Black women, to have a mental health assessment done. That bill never got anywhere. So she understood and understands that that is an issue that needs to be looked at, because, like I say, a lot of it could be contributed to mental health. But we don't care about the mental health of women or Black women of color specifically. And so that bill didn't go anywhere. The bill looking at maternal mortality in Black women specifically passed in the special session. But the other bill didn't even get off of the floor. Mm-hmm. I mean, it didn't go anywhere. What? We want to talk about mental health? We could curl us about these women killing themselves. Good. That's just how many we don't have to kill.
Wow. Context of white supremacy. You talked about the self-medicating because of the stress of racism that a lot of Black mothers might be experiencing. Do you all have a position on whether or not it's healthy in terms of cannabis consumption? I know that's one that we've talked about before, and people have had different opinions. Do you all have a position on whether or not that's healthy to be consumed during pregnancy?
Well, I don't have a position on it. I don't know if anybody have a position on it. Have we really did any study on it, on cannabis consumption during pregnancy? I wish I could give a comment on that, but we've not been asked about that one. I personally have not even really looked into what cannabis consumption would be. I just personally believe that cannabis is lifted up because it's just another way or an easier way to criminalize Black women and Black lives. And so if we can just kind of get you caught up in the system with weed, then that's what we'll do.
Hmm.
But I might need to go back and relook at that again. I haven't looked at it. I will say sometimes that I have a blind spot in some areas, and there are things that I look at and say, you know what, that's just another way that white folk trying to catch Black folk up. And I know that's not the way to look at it. I need to do a little bit more research on it. So that's something I go back and look at again.
I am still learning. A pregnant Black mother asked me about that last week. And I
don't want to.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I was gonna say I don't want to be too quick to speak on something I don't know about, but this is like you're the first person that ever asked this, but I literally had never given it that. I never thought about cannabis.
I am still learning. Like I said, a pregnant Black mother asked me that last week, and I said I will ask that question next week when we do the program. So I am still learning myself. I will continue inquiring. I saw a few folks who had hands. I'll try and nab some of our listeners who dialed in with a question. Thomas in New York, did you have a question for Miss Jones? You should be with us.
Good evening, Gus. Good evening to the guests.
Greetings.
Greetings, sir. I did have good evening, ma'am. With the children, the high mother mortality rate after birth in Texas, just to be reminded that Texas was a state that the slave owners would take the slaves when they owed money to the bank, and the bank was going to confiscate their slaves. They would run to Texas. So they didn't have laws that really protected slaves at all, and I think that still carries over to this day. With the mother mortality rate, do you think any of this would have to do with the fact that they're giving cesarean at a rate that's almost 3 to 4 times more than white women, and sometimes taking those cesareans, having those cesareans, those women will end up on pain medications and things when they go home?
Yeah, I've discussed that before, the high rates of cesarean sections among Black women. We are definitely offered them more than anybody else, and we are offered a more invasive cesarean section than other women. And by that, I mean, you know, a more deeper cut. They don't do it that often now, but we still have a more invasive surgery. And, yeah, sending women home with pain pills, with no real instructions on how to take them, and also no access to care when we keep going back saying, I'm in pain, because after all, I have had surgery, and I'm supposed to be in pain, and you keep sending me home saying everything is okay, then what do you think I'm going to do? If those pills are there, I'm going to take it. And so I don't have any proof of that. But that is a conversation that I've had before, and how we looked at that. I don't necessarily think that when there's been an overdose or whatever, I don't necessarily think that they were with an intention of killing themselves. I do believe that for the better part, a lot of that could have been trying to alleviate pain in the only way that they knew how.
And my last question for you, and thank you for answering that, and this is a somewhat off topic, but it could be on topic as well. You said you're in the Texas area. Were you affected by the hurricane? If you were, or even if you weren't, can you share with us anything that you've seen down there that they haven't put in the mainstream media?
I was not. I live in Dallas, and Dallas is in North Texas. And that is such a wide distance there from North Texas to South Texas. There were women, people who fell in the gap, who were not necessarily getting the help, some of the help that they needed. So one of the things that we decided to do at the Athea Center, since we knew we weren't going to send money to like these larger organizations, the Red Cross or whatever, we just kind of put out there to some of our community who may have known women who were in like Houston or Beaumont or something like that, who may have needed help to get back home. We would help women individually. We're a small organization, so that's what we did. There were a few women and children that we were able to get back from Houston to the East Coast or wherever it is that they were living at. So, because we knew that some of those women, especially if they were women living with HIV, they may not be as quick to go and ask for services for fear of their diagnosis becoming an issue. So we kind of did it that way.
Appreciate that, Thomas in New York. Let's see, the person that dialed in, I guess if you dialed in on a headset, I don't know if you're on the vote line or what have you, but if you have a question for Ms. Jones, you should be with us.
Hello?
Yes, ma'am.
Hi. Thank you to Jeff and the guest. I wanted to ask if there are ever discussions of the Black women and uterine fibroids. Thank you.
So I'm just informed, as it relates to uterine fibroids, I was just informed a couple of weeks ago, and maybe a month or so ago, I've been traveling a lot the last 3 months, by my program director, and she brought that to my attention around Black women and uterine fibroids, and that's something that we're going to be taking on in 2018. I don't have a lot. I wasn't aware of that either until she brought it to my attention, so we're going to be having conversations and looking into that.
Wonderful.
Like, it's strange in Texas. Yeah, Texas is strange. It seems like there's a lot of stuff going on, and there are a lot of people doing some amazing stuff in Texas, but it's kind of fragmented. And so there's very few of us that's Black that have any kind of funding or any kind of resources that's really, you know, that we don't, that this can literally be our 9-to-5. And so it's just so many things that's popping up, and you're just trying to be all these places at the same time. And it's almost hard. It's almost next to impossible to do. So we're almost having to do it on a micro level where we would love to be doing it on a macro, hoping soon that we're going to get funding where we'll be able to do micro grants or mini grants to other folk who are doing some amazing movement work in Texas so that we can really have a network of stuff happening in the state.
That answer your question, ma'am?
Yes, thank you, and thanks for the work that she does. Thanks.
For sure.
Thank you.
You all can visit the website, theafiacenter.org. One of our callers in Wisconsin, if you had a question for Ms. Jones, you should be with us.
Yes, thank you so much. Thank you for coming on the show, Ms. Jones. I just had a question kind of similar to what Thomas from UNORC had. I was just wondering, is, you know, the difference in the number of deaths of Black women or even children if they have vaginal births versus the C-sections, or the way that the women are given birth in hospitals, or if they're at home with midwives, is it a difference in the deaths? Do they have anything with the deaths of Black women after giving birth?
It is definitely a difference if the women are, if they're using midwifery, doulas, more ancestral birthing practices, the death rate is way lower. And of course, the cost of birth is way lower. That's not talked about a lot. And so that's part of the ask that we're doing with the AFIA Center, and we're saying, you know, to fund, not so much as to fund, but to look at these ancestral practices in birthing so that we can lower these numbers among Black women. As it relates to vaginal birth as or C-section, there's not a wide difference in that, and if it is, I've not seen it. With those deaths, just by the nature of the fact that the cesarean section is surgical, that's going to make those numbers go up anyway, because whenever there's surgery, there's those side effects of the things that can happen, especially as we look at the eclampsia piece of it, like blood clots, hemorrhaging, and things of that nature, like coronary conditions or so. But it didn't give like any hard documentation on vaginal compared to C-section.
Well, thank you very much.
Appreciate that. Person who dialed in, let's see, last four digits, 4443. Person who dialed in, last four digits, 4443. Did you have a question?
Yeah, I had a couple questions. Ms. Jones, I was wondering if your program, like, was, let's just say, very successful, like you got funding from somewhere, and you really helped out like a lot of Black women, like large numbers. Like, how do you think white people would react?
How do I think white people would react if we were very successful in helping Black women?
Yes.
Probably one or two things. We would probably not get funded anymore, because I don't necessarily think we're designed. I don't think the goal is to make sure that we are successful. The goal is to make sure that people don't feel guilty about not giving money to Black organizations to do work with Black people. But that's just me. Nobody's ever said that to me. That's, I'm an old woman, so I'm just thinking that way. And then secondly, I think that there are a group of people who would be okay with the fact that Black women are no longer dying. But yeah, that's just where I'm at with it. People would say, Black women are not dying anymore. She don't need funding anymore. So let's go on to the next thing that's killing Black folk. And since she's not doing that, when we going to give it to the next girl of the day? So I don't necessarily see our funding being long, long time. But as long as we have it, we're going to continue to do the work. But I do hope that we find out why Black women are dying and that they stop. Or we know why they're dying and we address it in a way in which Black women will no longer be dying.
Do you think white people would be angry?
I don't think white people would be angry. I don't probably think they care one way or the other. I mean, they say they care, but I don't think they care one way or the other. But I don't necessarily think they're like, I don't think they'd be walking around like mad saying, we're going to go burn her clinic down because we don't have a clinic. We're going to go burn her office down because she found out she stopped Black women from dying. So I don't think it would be that kind of a visceral response. I don't think they'd be like turning flips in the street either.
Okay.
I don't want to talk, like I can't talk for no white people because I'm not a white person.
Yeah.
But like, I don't think they'd just be like fighting mad or something like that. I don't. Now, I think that could be a certain level of naivety on my part, and I own that, but I don't think they'd be turning flips. I don't think I'd get a parade, but I don't know how angry it would be either.
Okay, thank you. I had just one last question. I traveled to Southern Africa, and I was with an associate, and he pointed at a female and said that she had, or that either she had AIDS or that she was taking AIDS medication. And I asked her how she knew. I sort of like laughed at him, like, what? Like, how do you know? And he talked about her physical appearance, like that it's, to him, like her physical appearance was distorted, like she had like an upper, like her upper body or upper torso was larger than her lower body. So I was wondering if, so basically he said that the medication was like deforming or something. So I was wondering if what was your experience with the HIV, AIDS medication that the women that you know are receiving?
So there is some medication, not as much now as it used to be, because supposedly the medications are better. They're not quite as toxic. So there are some medications. There was a class of HIV meds. There's five or six different classes that out of those classes of medications that cause body malforming. So what it did, it caused maldistribution of body fat. So it could cause you to lose body fat, which can make you, like in your limbs, can make your arms and your legs very small, but also could cause distribution of body fat in your like calf area. So you can have like really huge stomach. Some women or some people would have like a really huge collection of fat on the back of their neck, on the back of their neck, up the nape of their head and around their chin area. You don't see that as much as you used to see. You may see it in countries like Africa or whatever. You shouldn't, but you may. But it's very rare. But that did happen for people who were taking one of the classes of HIV drugs. It caused maldistribution of body fat, and that was lipodystrophy or lipoatrophy. And so the lipoatrophy meant that you lost a lot of body fat, and lipodystrophy meant that you got body fat, and it was kind of like visceral fat or whatever, like it's like right under the skin, not like around muscle or whatever, so that even when you exercise a lot, you couldn't get rid of it. And then the fat that was lost, even if you worked out a lot, you couldn't really gain that mass back like you needed to. But again, it's not, I know in the United States, you rarely, because when I see somebody with it now, I'm like, wow, they still must be taking a very old regimen. Because if they're taking a new regimen, that was one of the things, that's some of the things that was looked at, and that toxicity is different and it shouldn't be happening. But again, like I say, in a country like Africa, I'm not exactly sure if you would see that now. So that could possibly be.
Thank you.
Appreciate that call. Let's see. Mhandisi, if you had a question for Ms. Jones, you should be with us. Mhandisi.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Greetings. My question is, if Black people ended the system of white supremacy next year, how would that affect the Black maternal mortality rate the following year? And also, how would that affect the Black female health that following year?
Well, if I don't know if I'm qualified to answer that, but I will give it a try. If Black people, if we ended anything this year, I don't think we would see the effects of it that soon, because what we are dealing with now with maternal mortality and anything else is historical. It didn't just start when these reports came out. So I just believe that it would, ending white supremacy, it needs to happen, but I don't think we would see the results of it in as short a term as a year. Because that's just one thing that would have to happen, maternal mortality. But look at all of the others. I mean, all of the other things that we're having to deal with. So, again, like I said, I'm not an expert in that type in providing that kind of information. But I just, you know, I don't see how we could see a real change in a year on something that has such a long historical effect on Black people's lives in America.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Appreciate that. Person that dialed in, Princess, good to hear from you, ma'am. Did you have a question for Ms. Jones?
Not yet. I'm just listening for now.
Right on. She had her hand up. Other folks, if you have a question... The number again, not a problem. The number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you have a question. Going back, do you all do training? You talked about the benefits of doing a natural birth as opposed to going the hospital route and possible dangers that and additional expenses. Do you all train midwives and the preparation if you're going to do the natural childbirth?
So we do not, as of today, train midwives, right? So we don't have the credentials to do that. Mm-hmm. But we are within the next 30 to 45 days, we will be sponsoring women to participate in a training for doulas. And so we will do it on scholarships. So we're going to make it available for women. We're going to pay for partnering with a sister organization in Austin. And we're going to pay for about 5 or 6 women to train to become doulas. I'm going to be one of those doulas. And in the next 3 or 4 months, I'm going to be going back to school to become a midwife.
Spectacular. Spectacular. What do you, well, I guess soon you all will be able to do more things directly yourselves. Do you all refer out if people come in and they're asking for those type of resources to try to find a black midwife, black doula, that sort of thing?
Yes, yes we do. We are having a hard time finding them in Dallas. But there's a young sister that we're going to be working with. I'm just learning of her. Her name is Nakia. And I believe she's in Fort Worth, that's near Dallas. And so she's going to be doing our doula training here. And because I know sisters outside of Texas that do it, but right here in Texas. So we're excited. And so, yeah, the goal is that we're going to be doing a lot of these things ourselves. And we're going to be making these opportunities available for when we're actually looking at some short-term programs, whereby we're hoping to see the erection or whatever of a, kind of ancestral care birthing center in some of our in one of our most impoverished areas in Dallas. Hopefully that will come to pass, and with the goal of having black women of color, doulas and birth coaches and midwives or whatever, maybe we'll get to, you know, hopefully can bring them our way. But we want to change that. It's not so easy to find black doulas and black midwives here in this area. But the way to change it is to bring them in. I have one of my mentors, and when I still am an advocate and an activist. He said, if you don't see what you want, you create it. And so I'm not going to sit around here and keep complaining that we don't have black midwives and black doulas. What we're going to do is create a space. We're going to create that opportunity for it to happen.
Spectacular. I know I'm in Washington State, and I hear that same problem from black mothers. I heard it directly from a pregnant black mother. Really difficult time finding black midwives, black doulas, especially in Washington State, because we have a substantially lower population of black people. Are you aware of like online resources or directories for that sort of thing?
Yeah, and I don't want to give you the wrong name. And for whatever reason, I said, they're probably going to ask me that. So I'm going to try to go online and find his name so I will have the right name for it. But there is an organization in New York, and they're called Ancient Song Doula Services. There are some amazing sisters, ANCIENT Song Doula Services, and they are my go-to. Like, if I wouldn't have hooked up with this sister in Dallas, in Austin, I was going to literally go to New York and get my training from them. I am a part of another group that they're with, Black RJ, Black Women Doing Reproductive Justice Work, but that's how I met them. But they do some amazing work in New York, and they train doulas, and they also can resource folks to doulas or midwives or midwifery services, natural birth services. I here in Dallas, I'm usually going to call, and one of the ladies that I'm talking about, Darlene she was in the article that Ann wrote. And I would call Darlene and say, Darlene, what's happening in Texas? Who can I find? She's who I'm partnering with to do, get the doula training started. And that's how I know about Nakia. And I met Nakia a couple of months ago, but just didn't know that I had met her. We did a one-day event, and we brought in women that we were looking for doulas and midwives. And so we met one doula, a sister here in Dallas doing some amazing work and specializing in areas with women living with HIV. And also Nakia, who left the hospital, whatever, to start her own midwifery center or however that's called. And so we're like, since we did this report, it's also opened our eyes. And so we are now seeing the deficit of these things in our communities. So we're trying to do what we can to close that gap and to, if nothing else, have a resource book or where people can go and find these services. So it's not easy here. I mean, you're saying you live in Washington State. It's difficult. I would love to be on this phone and say, oh, it's easy, honey. You can just, cause like when I go places and I talk about doulas, everybody tell me, well, you know, Erica Badu is a doula. Well, yeah, I do know Erica Badu is a doula. I heard that, but I can't get to Erica. And I don't know how to get her services.
Keep it real.
But we're hoping that we'll be, hoping we'll be able to connect with her. You know, I don't know.
Just being truthful, that is a major problem. I know she was the keynote speaker for the International Center for Traditional Childbearing back in 2012. I do remember Ms. Monroe talking to us about that. I also wanted to know, I guess, do you all have resources for Black fathers, things that they can do to help during the pregnancy, either stress reduction or just anything that would be helpful in this process?
So when we start our doula services, it's going to be whole family. It's not just going to be mom. We will be, that's one thing I'm asking for specifically. I'm asking to get training to bring fathers in this process. So we're looking for that. But I know when we start doing it, it will be a part of our services.
Spectacular.
I think it's very necessary.
Absolutely. Do you have suggestions for, I guess, literature or resources that you would encourage first-time moms, first-time being pregnant, resources, literature that you would encourage that they check out?
I do not. All of these things are so new to us. When I tell you, I would love to lie. I don't love to lie, but I would love to be able to sit here, because it would be a lie and tell you that we are so entrenched in this. We have all the answers. Nope, it was after we discovered that this was really happening in our state that we said, not only do we have to report on it, we've got to find some solutions to this, and we've got to create what's not there. And so we are literally in the beginning stages of creating this. And that's why we resource and we reach out to other people. Like when Ann was talking to us, we were like, we can give you this, but now we got to give you the name of some folk who can give you the information that you really need as it relates to the doulas and midwifery and all of these things. And so that's what we are. We are like a year into this. We started this report, and we knew October of 2016 that we were going to do it. My staff knew that we were in the process of planning and putting on the first Texas Black Women's Reproductive Justice Summit. Mm-hmm. And they knew immediately when that summit was over, we were going to start to gather our information and start putting our ducks in a row to hit this legislative session in 2017 really hard, trying to get some answers around maternal mortality. We had no idea what we were going to walk into, and we had no idea that this thing was going to take such a life of its own. And so that's where we are now. We are working this. We're planning it as we work it. And when I see those deficits, when I see those gaps, deficits too, but I also see those gaps. We're writing it down. This is what's got to be done. And so you asked me that question tonight. So there's two things that I've got to now do research on. I mean, we would get the books in a way, because that's what we do. We have a gazillion books in our offices around reproductive justice, Black women's movement kind of work. That's what we do. When our interns come, there's required reading that they have to read, required videos that they have to look at or listen to, all of that stuff. So we will do that same thing with trying to decrease the rate of maternal mortality. So I may not have the answer for you tonight, but what I can guarantee you is if I get to talk to you the next time about this, you will have answers to that, because it will be in place.
Right on. Still learning. I love it. What's some of the required reading or viewing that you all offer for interns?
So when they come in, they have to look at videos or YouTubes, whatever, on Loretta Ross. They have to read the Combahee River Papers. They have to read The Killing of the Black Body. They have to read When and Where I Enter. Those are just a few of the things that they have to read.
Right on. Dorothy Roberts, 3-time guest on the program, one of my favorites.
One day we're gonna get her to Dallas. I know people who know her, so if she's listening tonight, one day, Dorothy Roberts, we're gonna get you to Dallas. We need you. But yeah, that book is a required reading right there. The Killing of the Black Body. You have to read that one, or else you're not gonna be interning at the appeals center or volunteering. You're definitely not gonna work.
2009, she was on
you
the program. Phenomenal work, phenomenal book. I follow her on Twitter. I'm surprised. She seems like she's so passionate about these issues that if you could get in touch with her, I'm sure she'd try to work something out. She's been on the program 3 times. Huge fan of her work.
Wow.
I see, Emmy, you dialed in with a question. Do you have a question for Ms. Marcia Jones, co-founder and executive director of the AFIA Center?
Greetings. Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. I think the work that you're doing is awesome. And I had one question. I was curious that with such a shortage of traditional birth centers or midwives or doulas and whatnot, do you prepare the women who come to the center with what to expect when they go into doctor's offices to have birth, like questions that they should ask or things they should look out for or like suspicions they should have or what to reject or what to accept?
So because we are just creating this particular program, those are things that will be put in place. We are working collectively now with the Black Mamas Matter Alliance. And so part of that's a part of the work that we plan to do, not just here in Dallas, but nationally, because what you said, with such a shortage, a lot of the work is going to have to be done in these organizations and one-on-one. And so part of what we are looking at is defining what holistic care is, educating women, educating community women of not just the childbearing age, because it's a family thing, of what holistic care should look like, what women should expect when they go, like the exact same thing that you just asked me, what they should expect, what should be a red sign or whatever, that something's not right here. Being able to identify physicians or biases, you know, that these ways that we are looked at when we are coming, when we enter services and how we are treated, and being able to identify these things, knowing when you're not in a place that's going to produce the results that you're looking for. So we are in these things are in play as we speak. There are organizations who's already doing it. But again, I'm not sure if you heard earlier, We are really, really new into this. And so we have a lot of work behind us. We have a lot of work in front of us, and we're doing it as we go along. But to make sure that we do this work in the best way possible, that's yielding the best results possible, we are aligning ourselves with sisters across the country, especially sisters in the Deep South, who's doing this work and doing it very well. And there again, I refer back to the Black Mamas Matter Alliance, the BBMA, and it's headed the face that you see on it is Dr. Joy Creer, and she has an organization. She do work around birth equity among Black women of color, and Sister Song Reproductive Collective. So organizations like that are part of this Black Mamas Matter Alliance, and we are working really, really hard to catch up and get this thing as close as we possibly can on an even playing ground. And again, not to be redundant, but the question you asked, these are the questions that we are preparing, and some women are already doing it, to ask women when they come into our organizations, so that while we cannot be in these centers with them, we may not be providing their birth services, but we can provide them with the tools to make sure that they will get the optimum birthing experience.
And then, thank you. I'm curious, just off top, if you're aware, is it cheaper or less expensive for insurances, for doctor's offices, and for women who don't have insurance to have a C-section versus having a birth? Because in my mind, I would just think that it costs more money to have a C-section. So it could it be possible that...
Like,
I'm sorry.
No, I was going to say, I thought you were finished answering your question. No, you move forward. I want to listen to your question.
Only because if Black women are on, like, Medicaid and whatnot, like some type of government assistance, like stereotypically or whatever, then if the offices are able to bill for C-sections, then they get more money if the C-section is more expensive. And I was just curious if that had anything to do with it. Like, did you run across that at all?
So I've not heard anybody say that, but because I believe that, you know, because we live in a capitalist society, that people always want to get the most money that they can get, because it definitely costs more money for a cesarean than it do for a vaginal birth, but it costs way more money for a vaginal birth than it do for a birth that's done with midwives.
Mm-hmm.
So you have, you have doula, midwife services, and all of that together for the entire birth could probably cost less than $10,000. And just to go into a hospital to have a vaginal birth is like probably $15,000, $18,000. And then if it's a cesarean, you know, that's going to be like double or if not triple. So it's way more less expensive to have vaginal than cesarean, and way more less expensive to have midwife in opposed to gynecologist or doctor or whatever, which would definitely be an incentive for the insurance companies to would rather pay for a cesarean than to pay for to bill for a midwife. Mm-hmm. But you're going to get more money.
I see. And then the last thing I wanted to say is, you know, I know that Ms. Badu is from Texas, but one thing I will just say this, because y'all are new and whatnot, but I know that she really cares about Texas, or at least she act like she do. So on Instagram, maybe if y'all made a video and like tagged her, maybe she would come and do something. It was just like a thought when y'all said it, like y'all were joking back and forth. But maybe if like y'all have a page and make like a little video and tag her, she might respond and maybe like do something. But that was it. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much. And as soon as we get through, I'm going to put my digital organizer on that, because, man, let me tell you, sister, that was not a joke. I would do anything to get in contact or to get Dorothy Roberts' attention, because that her book was a life changer, a game changer for me. That's why it's required reading for the women who come into our organization.
Well, I think Emmy was talking about Erykah Badu and saying that you should do the video for her, but that might work for Dorothy Roberts as well, because, like I said,
what? I'll do the same thing with Erica. I mean, hey, she's right. Now, I really wasn't that serious about. I was serious about what I said. I know Erica, but I was also serious about the fact that we are going to see if we can connect with her, because I was on a panel yesterday and we were talking about this, and I was talking to Darlene, and I was saying, you know, people always say whenever you talk about midwifery, I mean about doulas in Dallas, they bring up Erica, and I'm like, yeah, but I don't know how to get in touch with Erica, and it's strange because Erica do work with a lady here that I do work with, so I would say to both you and the sister who was on the call a minute ago, I probably haven't done my due diligence because probably I know her, I know a way of getting in touch with her a lot better than I think I do. I haven't done my due diligence, so I'm going to use your phrase right now. You learn something every day, and so I'm definitely going to put my digital organizer on this to reach out to her, but I'm also going to look into the resources or the people that I know, who, like, I know who do her hair and her head wrap. Like, I know her. I can just pick up the phone and call her. I hadn't thought about it until I was on this here, right here tonight, talking to you. You learn something new every day. Still learn.
Still learning. Inspiration is a great thing. Yeah. Context yeah. of white supremacy and the Black Mamas Matter Alliance. They should be visiting us next week. Since this is important subject matter, we should have more time on it. So they should be hanging out with us next week. Just keep listening. Do you have?
I would. Yeah, because they're phenomenal.
There's been so much talk over the past, really most of the year, but it certainly seems to have intensified over the last 2-3 months or so with the Me Too campaign and the focus on sexual harassment and people saying that, hey, women are empowered and they're not going to take this sort of abuse anymore. And I think Gabrielle Union, she had an article in the New York Times today where she said white women are having an empowerment moment. I do not see the same for Black females. And I thought that was really important with all of this. Do you? And the thing that it reminded me of, I have a hard time reconciling people saying that, you know, white women are stepping forward and they're not going to take sexism anymore. And they're stepping forward to be empowered when 51% of, or I think it was 52% of white women voters supported Donald Trump. It just seems very contradictory.
It seems all of that disingenuous and all. yeah, so I feel the same way. I didn't see the article, but that's something that's been, you know, on my mind. And I try to lift that up every time I hear this whole move here because I sat on a panel this weekend, and it was in reference to Robert Kelly or R. Kelly and this whole thing around these women and the stories that's been coming up, and that this is nothing new. But, of course, these have been stories about Black women, Black girls, Black women or whatever, and there's been no sense of urgency around the abuse of our bodies and how that's played out. And the only reason that this, the reason that, that the traction that we're seeing right now is that these are white women. And so, yeah, white women are saying we're not going to take it anymore. We've been saying we're not going to take it anymore. Shoot, nobody cared. Because after all, these were men, Black, white, or whatever. Attacking Black women's bodies. And so, I mean, while I think it's a moment, you know, and go with it, girl, but we've been fighting this a long time. Like, we was fighting your daddy.
And mother.
And his daddy. Yeah, when they were attacking our bodies. So, girl, sit down somewhere. But, yeah. I didn't read the article that Gabrielle Union put in, but I'm pretty sure that I could co-sign on that.
I was looking online earlier today. I was just looking to see the number of fertility clinics in the Dallas area. I think I found at least four or five in the Dallas, Fort Worth area, and they were offering in vitro fertilization and all sorts of wonderful services. If you're having any sort of difficulties with pregnancy, they had LGBT family planning, lots of options, and probably more to come with CRISPR evolving daily. It's seeming that they're coming with more and more techniques and uses for this really refined gene editing techniques. And I contrasted that with what you all are focusing on, where Black mothers are missing out on basic services. I think you've emphasized consistently where you have Black mothers who are suffering and in pain from the Quiet Crisis article, Cassandra Lynn Perkins, where she's in pain and going to the hospital and it just gets minimized and dismissed and then she ends up dying, where Black mothers are struggling to get basic services. If you are white and affluent, you can get the most designer services possible for your pregnancy. Just can you talk about that contrast, which seems to be getting worse?
Well, I can talk about it. People get tired of hearing me talk about it, but that, you said it. I don't even know what you're going to talk about. There's just no priority set on Black women's lives. I mean, the irony of being in a state, being in a city or whatever, where women are literally dying. Like, so this is the thing, because I'm an RJ organization, and we stand strong around the fact that women have the right to parent if they want to parent and not parent. So on the one hand, you have white girls who get gazillions of dollars a year to walk around, and protest against losing access to have abortions. In that same breath, they have gazillions of access to being able to have a child if they should choose to have one in any way that they want to be able to do it. But in that same breath, Black women are dying if they so choose to have a child, and these same white girls who want us to be protesting up and down the streets with them to be able to have an abortion, they're not standing in that line with us when we're saying that Black women are dying to figure out if they want to have a child. And the hypocrisy of it drives me crazy sometimes. And, that's another level of frustration for me. You living in a state here where you can provide all of this stuff, but you cannot recognize that these women are dying, and they're dying. And it's all the same dollars. You're putting all of this money into reproductive health choices, and you're taking away dollars from reproductive health choices. And because you're doing this, people are dying. In the same breath that another people, just because of race, they get to enjoy life. And this don't seem to be a problem. None whatsoever. So all of the work, all of it is so conflicting that you have to meditate and everything else just to stay focused, because I know that for me it is. It's not so plain and cut and dry. And I just can't see myself, we do work really hard to make sure that women have choices. But it's hard for me to stand in line with them on that side of the fence when you're not standing in line with me trying to scream that Black women are dying. Because, see, organization like the Athea Center, we're just getting funded to do this kind of work. And so we are behind the gun. And as you've been getting funded to do it, you've been knowing Black women are dying. So all of it is just all frustrating.
Indeed.
All of it.
Are you familiar with Mark Crutcher's documentary Ma'afa 21?
No, I'm not.
Oh, okay. I think it came out in around 2009. It's been out maybe close to 10 years, but it's about abortions, specifically the high number of Black children that are aborted, and they kind of put it in the context of eugenics and the history of racism, Margaret Sanger, and just talking about the mm-hmm. long continuation of not valuing Black mothers, Black pregnancies, Black children. But yeah, I was just curious if you were familiar, because it's the people that did the documentary. It's a group of predominantly white people who they are opposed to abortion. They don't have very many Black members, but they did this documentary, which, yeah, if you haven't seen it, I can't really ask the question, but yeah, I was just curious if you were familiar with it. It's called Ma'afa 21. Do you have any suggestions or things that you all offer in terms of natural ways that Black mothers can reduce stress during pregnancy? I think that was something you talked about as being a big problem as well.
The only, natural way to reduce stress, trying to find a way to carve out time in a day to have time just for yourself. Me personally, I meditate, and these are things that I suggest to people, meditate. I try and keep stuff burning around in my house or whatever that create calm and energy. Separating myself sometimes from, or yourself or whatever, from the things that that you have already identified that cause you the most stress. It's just, I don't know, no specific thing to do with the exception of meditating, because depending on the woman, you can't actually ask people to check out of their everyday living, because, I don't know, become un-Black. It's because just us being Black can tend to be so stressful. And so you just have to find those ways, like I said, burning incense, having water around, water is very calming for me. Burning sage. Just all of those kind of things, having calming stones. I keep stones, different kind of stones, in my purse or on my person, to kind of rub together or just to have there. Just those kind of practices. Because so many of the women, because I know where we operated in Dallas, the women that come to our organization, so the women who die from maternal mortality, they have these issues. They come from so many different spectrums of the socioeconomic statuses. But that's not our case. We are, for the better part, of dealing with women who are poor, who are receiving their services at clinics, who are underemployed and unemployed, and sometimes who are living with folks while they're pregnant and living in a house where there are a whole lot of other people in the house, and there is no place to go break away to, and there's also no shelter that I can send them to. And so it's not that luxury of me being able to talk to the Black woman who have a lot more access than the other, where she can go on a trip, or she can see her counselor or whatever, or she can see all these things to reduce stress, or
she already have money in the bank, and so she don't have to, you know, so focus on the things that you do have so that you don't have to focus on the things that you don't have so you don't have to focus on the things that might be. Well, for the women that we are working with, all of that stuff is. I already don't have the money. I'm not sure where I'm going to live when this baby is born. I'm not sure how this baby's dad is going to act because they're already acting bad now. What is this going to be after this baby's born? I'm already maybe faced with prison. I've already got tickets. I might go jail. See, all this stuff is already in place, so I'm not exactly sure. I know how to ask her to disconnect. So we do those things. We go through the process, breathing, some breathing exercises, you know. Let's sit around and I don't know if I want you to talk about it because talking about it may be more stressful than not talking about it, so let's write about it. So it's one of those things where we just have to take it one woman at a time, which is why it's important that we align ourselves with a group like the Black Mamas Matter Alliance, because all the stuff that we think that we're going to be faced with, somebody in that alliance has been faced with it. And so we get to get answers to those questions that we don't have, because I tell you, sometimes it's like sitting here talking to you, I'm already exhausted. Because what we are faced with in Texas is huge, because there's not anybody else doing it. And so in no one specific way, you know, like I said, I was talking to Darlene yesterday and we were just like, you know, if we can just get 10 women trained to be doulas, that'll make some kind of a difference. You know, if we can just, if one more Black woman in Texas can become a midwife, like we're almost starting from scratch on a problem that's so huge.
I know it can definitely seem daunting, but the work that you all are doing, I think it's critical. It's super appreciated. It sounds like to be in the infancy of starting out, it seems that you all have done a lot and have so much in store. Hopefully you can get as many folks as possible trained so you can go out and help as many folks as you can and just continue to build. For folks who want to support, to get more information, see some of the resources, the website again is theafiacenter.org. Address again, theafiacenter.org. Princess, did you have a question? Were you still just with us listening? Princess, did you have a question?
Yes, good evening. Sorry for the echoing. I just recently moved. But I did have a question for the guest. I was wondering, because I know you had indicated that this is a new organization that you guys are had founded and that you're starting from the ground up. So everything is kind of, you know, where it's at. But I was curious because a lot of times when Black people tend to, in this case, a lot of Black females, we tend to try and start organizations that, I guess, in a way, you know, just focus on our needs. When it comes to family matters, we forget that we do have Black males in the foreground. And I was just wondering whether or not, as things evolve, will this eventually include Black males? Because a lot of the problems, as you indicated just now, that a lot of females deal with, I guess, when they are going through pregnancy, is as far as the baby's father or, you know, things going on in the household. And I think I feel that it would be very important if the organization makes sure that they do put a focus on, you know, trying to include Black fathers in the process as well. I think that can kind of also help in developing both Black males and females in, you know, that nurturing and knowing how to be a part and raise a family. You know, regardless of whatever the circumstances. I mean, I don't have any kids. I'm just kind of thinking because I was just listening throughout the show. So I don't know if that makes sense. Because that could not make sense sometimes.
No, no, no. It makes all the sense in the world. And so we're not like exactly a new organization. We're new in this arena, but our organization have always been included of all folks. You know, we are a women-centered organization, but even when we were doing HIV work and we were talking with women about relationship stuff, very inclusive of the men in their lives, we always felt at the Afia Center that we cannot address things that's happening with women. If we say that women are becoming infected with HIV because they're having sex with heterosexual men, then we cannot address that properly if we're not having conversations together with the men that they're sleeping with. So we've always made that a part of our conversation. As we move forward to do this work around improving the birthing experience for women, one of the things, I don't know if you, I said it earlier, you may not have heard me because I ramble a lot. When we do our training, when we start to do our training around doula midwifery, one of the things that I'm asking is that there's a component in that we bring in men throughout this experience with the women that they're with, harm reduction in a harm reduction kind of way. If that woman is safe with that situation, we are going to, welcome that situation into the work that we do at the Afia Center, because we don't see that there's no other way of doing it. But thank you for like lifting that up, because we definitely believe that that's an important component to it.
Thank you for taking my question.
Indeed. I think we got all the folks who dialed in with questions.
Did I got one more.
Oh, Thomas in New York. Go ahead.
Yes. Do you have any information on if these women who are dying after childbirth, if their organs are being donated? Because women are 63% of the organ donors. Apparently more women organs could go in men than men organs could go in women. And of course, women organs could also go in women. And women are also the majority of the population, even though they're considered a minority. So I just wanted to know, have you had any experience of hearing that these women, after they die, what happened to their bodies and their organs?
So we have no information on if these women are organ donors or not. That's definitely something that can be thought about. Yeah, that's an interesting conversation to have. I'm not afraid of having that conversation as it relates to folk dying and having on their driver license that, well, folk getting sick or getting hurt and having on their driver license that they are organ donors, and then folk dying and there's no explainable reason why they died except for the fact that they're organ donors. But no, that's not a conversation that we've had as it relates to are these women organ donors or not. And it could possibly be that we're just trying to see why these women are dying. But all things should be considered in anything, especially when you're talking about people who've been marginalized. You can't leave anything up for a question.
Any of the folks that had a hand up, did we miss any other folks who had a question? I'll assume we nabbed all of the folks. The address again, theafiacenter.org. You can download the report that we read from a little bit earlier on the broadcast, The State of Black Women in Texas. You can see events that they have coming up, resources, great information you can contribute, brand new, or not brand new, but still in the infancy, with great plans to come, theafiacenter.org. Thank you so much, Ms. Jones, for sharing a bit of your Tuesday evening with us. You will have to keep us posted if you're able to get Erica Badu to come down and do an event with you all, or Dorothy Roberts. I'm a big fan of both of them. And yeah, in fact, I'll tweet out any of the folks. If you follow Dorothy Roberts on Twitter, maybe you can message and send the website for the AFIA Center, send the website and let them know that they're big fans and recommend Killing the Black Body. They're recommending her work and see if she can work something to come down and talk with the folks. That would be outstanding. But just thank you again, Ms. Jones. I hope you all keep up the outstanding work that you're doing. And we will hopefully have you back on the program. We can hear the update on that and hear what you all have planned for 2018.
Thank you so very much for reaching out to us.
Absolutely. Take excellent care of yourself. Continue doing the outstanding work down there in Texas. And we will speak with you soon, ma'am.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Good evening. Context of white supremacy. As I said, we should have, as mentioned, Black Mamas Matter, the Black Mamas Matter Alliance. They should be on the program next week. You can just stay tuned. Very important subject matter. We should have more information. See if they have some suggestions, resources for next week. I posted the link for Ancient Song Doula Services. She mentioned it on the broadcast. We can contact. They have an email section. They have a number listed where you can contact them if you are looking for doulas, midwife services. The address, AncientSongDoulaServices.com. AncientSongDoulaServices.com. I put it on the Facebook page, my Facebook page, and the Cow's Facebook page. I'll see if we can get them on the program as well so we can get out more resources, more information. Again, the iTunes feed updated. There had been tech issues that were beyond Gus T. It was a platform problem. Everyone that was using the platform allegedly was having the same issue with not being able to get their feeds updated for their different podcasts, but seems that has been taken care of. The iTunes feed, at least excluding this program, is up to date. All of the programs from the last 2 weeks or so uploaded to iTunes. You should be able to download and or stream the program without issue. Feel free. iTunes, Black Talk Radio Network, SoundCloud, YouTube. It's available in lots of spots, but I know some people have been struggling with that, frustrated with that over the last couple of weeks, as had I been. But at least for right now, that problem is corrected. We should be here this coming Thursday for Workplace Racism, normal time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, on Friday for the Wisdom of Psychopaths. That is our fourth study session. Normal time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, and the compensatory call-in this coming Saturday, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. Looking forward. In fact, next week, I think the day after the Black Mamas, Black Mamas Matter Alliance, after they visit us next Tuesday, I think we should have another white man on the program. He wrote this book about racism in the Trump era and how things have changed. We'll be looking forward to chatting it up with him next week. I think the book that he wrote just came out. It's called Alt-America. Alt-America. Should be fun. Also, if folks have examples, really great examples of the Voltron effect, I wanted to write out to explain that concept. I think that's one I can take credit for coining, but just to explain the concept, when you have an act of racism, white supremacy, or an incident of racism that is initiated with one white person, and then they end up getting assistance from other whites. Sometimes it could just be one or two other whites who come and assist them. Sometimes it could be lots, dozens, hundreds of other whites who come to assist them in practicing racism, white supremacy. It can be against one individual non-white person that they're targeting, or a large number of non-white people. But if folks have really great examples of that effect, the Voltron effect in action, that would be great. I was thinking of some that folks have mentioned on the program down through the years, and trying to narrow and pick out some of the best examples of that phenomenon. With that, folks who dialed in, if folks have any commentary that they wanted to add based on what we heard this evening from Ms. Jones, any of the commentary around maternal mortality rates or anything else that we were discussing, folks have any comments that they want to share?
Can I be heard?
Go ahead, bro.
Yes, sir. This is Amanda G. I was, if I were to ask a follow-up question to the black female guest, it would be, I would ask her, does she feel that white people is the overarching problem to black female health? And the reason I would ask that is because, you know, her response to my question before that that I asked regarding after white supremacy, or if we were to end white supremacy next year, what would happen the following year? How would that affect black female health? She was saying that there was a lot of things that we would have to, a lot of problems we would have to address. But if indeed white people are the overarching problem, then we wouldn't be able to address any of the other problems because white supremacy or white people have not been addressed. So that was what I was going to say.
Huh. Right on. Yeah, I thought, I agree. I do think the overarching, the primary problem remains whites, racist man, racist woman, racist child. Absolutely. I do think when she was given that answer, I think the part that at least to me stood out, the logic of it in saying that we're talking about problems that were the effects have been here for generations. So it might take some time to deal with all of that toxicity that has accumulated for centuries. We're talking about it might not be something that can be in terms of the health benefits, even if that problem was corrected, in terms of correcting all of the health deficits, that might take a little longer to correct. I think that I see the logic of why she would say that. Thomas in New York, did you have commentary?
Yes, I do. Today, an article came out, birth of U.S. baby, birth of first U.S. baby after uterus transplant. And they're going on in all these different articles that talk about this to, you know, these doctors are elated that they came up with this technology to put a uterus, another person's uterus inside of a white woman. And then she was able to carry this baby to term and give birth. I'm not sure if it was vaginal or cesarean, they didn't say, but there's no way that you come up with this science without a whole bunch of trial and error. That was the first thing I thought was, I wonder how did they come up with this? With, you know, I'm sure no one just said, yeah, experiment on me. And after hearing the lady, you know, it was just like, man, you know, I wonder if these women are purposely being taken out so that they can probably have all their uteruses stored somewhere, because these white women are not carrying their babies to term. In fact, I believe they're last in the country for carrying their babies to term. Asians are triple their rate. I think blacks are triple their rate. Latinos are quadruple. I mean, they're dead last. So I just thought that was interesting when I read that article. And I just wanted to say, you know, it's unrelated, so I won't say it. I'll mute my line. Thank you.
I know. Any of the other folks who dialed in, if you had a comment, observations you wanted to share, question, should be with us. Feel free. Folks satisfied? Everybody got in what they needed to say?
But you know what? I will just say this. I wanted to say this gentleman died. They say he killed himself. He owned the Golden Crest Crusher on Caribbean Bakery and Grills. And we have quite a few here in New York. And until I read the article, I always thought it was a white-owned business. I don't know why, but, you know, I just... And he apparently had 120 around the country. And You know, I just, they claim that it's on video with him putting a gun to his head and shooting himself, but of course they're not going to show that. But I just feel like this guy, I know that that organization, I saw when I walked past them on 125th Street that they were had a poster up saying that they raised $100,000 for kids to go to college. And, you know, so they were doing good things. And he was opening more restaurants. I just think that for them just to say this was a suicide and, you know, the guy was worth $70 million and he had a little debt. I mean, what all businesses do, it wasn't like he couldn't pay it off. I just thought that it's very suspicious. And here we have a black business owner, entrepreneur. And anytime something like this happens, I suspect racism. And I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Directly, indirectly, Lowell Hawthorne. Lowell Hawthorne, he passed away at the age of 57. I saw that earlier this week. I think we have a significant number of New York listeners. Some of them were tweeting it. I saw it in the New York Times. They had it on the front page that he passed allegedly from suicide. Either way, directly, indirectly, that is an indictment of the system of white supremacy. His passing at the age of 57.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I was going to say, yes, I agree. Her response was logical. And I would just say, I would say consider, yes, after white supremacy is ended, yes, there are problems that you have to solve. But I would say you could solve the problem so quickly that, you know, I would say even the next moment after white supremacy is ended, we would see significant change. So significant, we wouldn't even, like, we can't exactly fathom how significant the change would be. Just think of, you were saying, or she was saying that she might be able to get 10 women to become doulas. And I'm saying, well, if white supremacy was over, you might be able to get 10,000. You know, you might be able to do it in a very short period of time. I think black people are smart enough to figure out how to communicate with each other and get things done in an effective way if we're not being stopped. So I would just say that should be considered.
Absolutely. Eradicating white supremacy would exponentially make things just so much more efficient and easier to get done. Absolutely. And I think she said, too, like it she is not the best person. She is not the most qualified to speak to that, having never experienced what it would be like to not have white supremacy here and just the ease of getting things done. I'm not the most qualified to speak to that either. But yeah, it can only seems logical that it would be a lot easier to get things done, constructive things done. Did anything else folks wanted to make sure they got in?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I guess the article that Thomas was talking about, I saw like a video of it, and I guess what I thought was interesting, they said that like after the birth, I guess, because I guess the woman would be taking like antiretroviral drugs to try to, so that she could, I guess, accept the uterus, that they have another surgery to take out the uterus. So it's like you can have like multiple births using multiple uteruses. So, I mean, when I was listening to it, I thought it was disgusting, but I thought that was interesting to me that, you know, somebody could basically have multiple pregnancies over, I guess, a lifetime or until whenever, and basically just have the surgery over and over and over again. So that's what I thought was interesting. Thank you.
Context of white supremacy seems like another example of Yorugu, whites, their affinity for playing God. Anything else folks wanted to make sure they got in? I'm going to ask, when we have the folks on next week, about cannabis consumption during pregnancy. I had a pregnant black mother ask me to see if I could get some views on that from some of the folks that were coming on the program over the next few weeks. I will bring that up again. I'm surprised they don't have lots of data that's been talked about in such a prolific manner over the last 3-4 years, 5 or 6 years, really. I'm surprised they don't have lots of data out saying that it's great and will do lots to help out during pregnancy. But I will keep inquiring. Anything else? Are folks satisfied?
Just to add in on that, as for medical apartheid, they said that when the black kids were born, crack babies or addicted to cocaine, it had no difference in their life or IQ or anything growing up than the normal, you know, someone who wasn't. So I would imagine it would probably be the same study.
I would be curious. I will ask next week, the Black Mamas Matter Alliance. I think they should be on next Tuesday, a week from today exactly. Anything else folks needed to get in? Folks satisfied? Definitely encourage folks to check out Medical Apartheid, Harriet A. Washington. Outstanding text covers. I think you'll have a much better grasp for why these type of things continue to happen in the system of racism, white supremacy, and has been a long, deliberate campaign. I was glad when we were talking and she used the term privilege and just thinking, questioning, reflecting. And she said, yeah, I do think power would be more accurate, and I'm going to use that moving forward. Outstanding. And that's something that I always appreciate and look for. When I'm having conversation with other black people, other victims of racism, period, really, are they receptive? Do they seem willing to rethink, to re-examine some of their positions? Do they come with the sense that, hey, I am still learning. I'm a victim of racism. I don't know everything because I'm still in this position. So I will have to at least consider a few things unless I have definitively come to a conclusion after looking at the evidence. But having, as they say, an open mind to process and think about things, super beneficial. And if that is not present when I'm talking to another victim of racism, I also keep that in mind because that adjusts, you know, how I talk, how I move forward. It might even, you know, shorten the conversation if it seems like they are not still learning, they're not receptive to re-examining how they think about, you know, different concepts, particularly as it relates to white supremacy racism. Anywho, if you have a question, guest suggestion, gripe, thought, feel free. You can drop an email untiljustice@gmail.com. Untiljustice@gmail.com. I hope the broadcast was of some constructive value. I will check immediately to see if we're able to upload this broadcast post haste, as normally is the case. If it's able to do so and go right to iTunes, grand. Hopefully we won't have any more problems and we'll be able to just update as we broadcast and have no glitches. But I will see how all of that proceeds this evening and let folks know. With that, thanks to everyone tuning in for the broadcast. I will encourage sobriety. I think that would be best with regards to us replacing white supremacy with justice. There's a lot of evidence that racists, they have done a phenomenal job exploiting black people when we're under the influence, not able to make the best decisions. I think it would behoove us under conditions of terrorism to be thinking at the highest capacity possible at all times so we can make tremendous decisions. Number one, so we can come up with concepts to solve this problem, and so we can make great decisions to minimize the likelihood of being further exploited, pillaged, raped, terrorized by racist man, racist woman, racist child, especially if you're going to be out and about in a vehicle. Let's make sure that we are sober and buckled up. Let's do everything that we can to minimize contact with race soldiers. That said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, your brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.